Okay, fantastic. So just to recap, and we're just recording now. The guys at Azov, the trap mercenaries, are begmanding. This is the term that we coined, begmanding. I tried playing with other ones like demegging, like that, demegging. No, because it's like not as smooth, but you know, we got it figured out. So there they are. They're begmanding to be released. And we've deconstructed why that is. And why that is that they've been told that we're the good guys, we're with the West. This is like every movie you saw. They're all suffering from main character syndrome. They all believe that, you know, they're the main character in their lives and that they've been down there for a while. And there's like the guy with glasses, the guy with tattoos, the smart one, the techie one, the sniper, the machine gun guys. Like they're all these fucking archetypes, like they're in a movie. And there's no way they can die because the good guys in movies never die because the plot, their storyline continues onward. Like they're supposed to be that time in their life that they tell the story about being trapped at Azovstal. And you can't tell that story, you know, if you're dead. And how can you die to the Russians? Because the Russians aren't really a people. The Russians are just this other. They're just this kind of. The Russians don't really exist. The Russians are just a plot device from which the main characters trapped at Azov do all this bonding with each other. You know, they have all this meaningful time. There was some weddings. I think probably some people, I don't know how many weddings could have happened or under what condition. I mean, none of that really made any fucking sense to me. They bring girlfriends, did they kidnap women and then rape them into submission? I don't even know what, I mean, it doesn't make any fucking sense. If they weren't families already, did the guys bring girlfriends in there? Did they go out and hunt girls? With so many stories about rape, how many kidnappings could they've gotten away with? So they're down there with what they think are hot chicks or whatever that they've been raping for a month and a half. Now they've married them because now that's it. They won't let all these victims leave. I mean, you know, whatever. Fuck their broads. I mean, the ones that came with them on, you know, with clear intentions. But the children, they got to let them go, right? But they're not. So they were thinking, well, here we have this agreement. There's going to be something. We're going to trade for somebody. There's going to be Medvedchuk. There's going to be blah, blah, blah. But instead, it backfired. Instead, two kind of lower level intelligence assets from the UK got captured. I mean, they're just mercenaries, but they report back and stuff. They have handlers. They're not James Bond characters. You know, clearly they're not. But everyone who's somebody can give information to somebody. So everybody is simultaneously like an asset, an operative, many other, you know, people wear different hats, right? So those guys get fucking captured. And that just throws the whole thing off because now it's like they want to be traded for Medvedchuk. And it's like, no, dude, you're not. And then we've also been saying, like, fuck you, Medvedchuk. Like, why didn't you leave before February 28th? Like, you had 8 years to see which way the wind was blowing. You had 8 years to realize that you're not going to win an election there. Like, just look at the last two of them. Look at the 2014 after, you know, the coup. Like, how did Poroshenko win in every part of the country that the Party of Regions won before? Oh, because there was a coup and a military crackdown and they killed 40 to 100 Party of Regions supporters at the Odessa Trade Union House. Well, they were probably to the left of the Party of Regions, but they were innocent people. 40 to 100, they just set fire to the Trade Union House and just burnt alive. I saw the original footage. It was awful. That was 8 years ago. And I'm sorry. I mean, I know that Medvedchuk has did stuff. I remember keeping up with it. I think I reported on it at the time. He was going into the dome. He was trying to negotiate things. He was trying to keep things kind of calm and doing things with the you know, the problems with the OSCE, he was critical of them, but so what? You know, it didn't cost him anything. And he's either a high value enough person that really was in Russia's mind, someone that would lead the country someday. He wouldn't have been there. You know what I mean? He didn't apparently feel like he was that much of a threat to the power institution there, or he would have left. Like, this guy's a professional, you know, landing on his feet kind of snake kind of guy, right? So, yeah, snakes don't have feet, but you know what I mean? He lands on his feet. He's a snake, right? But he lands on his feet all the time. So I just don't buy it. And I didn't buy his wife. I mean, I couldn't afford his wife, but I didn't buy his wife's statement, you know, that she's deeply in love with the man. Maybe she is, but that shouldn't have been the part that she read, because it sounded very canned. But I just didn't buy the whole story. Did you? I just didn't buy the whole story. I'm like, why is he there? So these Azov guys think that they're going to be traded. Now they're there doing their kumbaya. Okay. Volin is begmanding that they be released, and he makes a very bizarre reference historically. Okay. To the Dunkirk, the Battle of Dunkirk. Now, just for whatever reason, it's become a popular mythology through different narratives, through the History Channel, that that Hitler let them leave or something. Like, it just wasn't, these countries were at war. If you saw what would happen, the bombings, the German bombings in England, devastating. In 1941, you know, this was just off the top of my head, as I recall, the Germans lost 270 aircraft. The British lost 150. The docks were totally destroyed. There was some natural geography that lent towards a makeshift scenario, and they were able to evacuate 330,000 out of 400,000 or so soldiers, okay? But it wasn't because Hitler let them go. They sacrificed, number one, they sacrificed between 30 and 60,000 of them in fighting or being in situations where there would have to be a fighting to capture. And then all of the, we talked about the Air Force losses on each side. Like, this was not just like, okay, you guys can go. I don't know how that mythology was going, but apparently some people believe it and Volin believes it. But if Volin believes it, then that just means that Putin is worse than Hitler. Because Hitler was willing to let his opponents go. But this was a fairly large army. This was 400,000, not 2,000. Now, at this point in time, looking at these guys stuck there, it's just bizarre, the messaging that they're doing. Like, think about their state of mind. If the guy's delivering these lines, like, does he believe what he's saying, or does he realize how crazy he sounds? And I just actually think that he doesn't even realize. I think that he's so gassed up. I mean, just look at where he is. Right? What a fucking idiot. How did he get himself? So just imagine him, like, be a neo-Nazi, be a Nazi, be like, you've kidnapped a bunch of girls. Now your guys have married all of them, or whatever. They're probably marrying each other at this point. it's like those prison scenarios. They were promised, they were told that there's no way that Russia is going to take Mariupol, that it's going to be a siege. And when Russia lays siege, just there was a lot of factors. Probably they had an optimal scenario, like Turkey's going to allow, you know, the there's not going to be. I don't think they understood. There's too many factors. I mean, I was going to start listing like, well, maybe they thought that the Turks would allow, you know, passage through the strait and there would be like naval reinforcement. I was just trying to think like what they could have thought, but I think they just really didn't think that Russia would go all in with Mariupol. Like, look at what Mariupol looks like. And I just think they didn't think that Russia was going to be able to do that without provoking like all of Europe to join the war, like in a more crazy way than it has, even though I would actually surmise that they pretty much have. I mean, they're pretty much all in. I mean, they just, Europe just doesn't really have that much to offer. There were lots of scenarios that were talked about in war games and stuff going back, you know, 5 years, 10 years. That's relevant. That's a relevant time frame, isn't it? 5 years. And Russia steamrolls Europe. Like, if the U.S. is not involved directly, like if the U.S. is just trying to arm Europe or whatever, and Russia says, oh, we're going to take Paris, we're going to take Berlin, we're going to take Paris, we're going to take all of it. And if they have no regard for human life, they still win. So the idea that there's a problem, that Russia's having a problem, like more than just the normal everyday problems, there's always going to be a snafu, right? Situation normal, all fucked up. There's always going to be snafu. But the idea that Russia got into a FUBAR situation, fucked up beyond all recognition, the idea that Russia got into FUBAR is ridiculous. But the thing is, you can point to all these snafus, which are invariable aspects of large-scale operations. You're going to have snafu after snafu, but you know what? That's normal. Situation normal. Russia's only in there with, like, what, 15% of its force in Ukraine? And they're controlling the time. It's very obvious they're controlling the time. When things happen, at what speed. They're, like, they're massaging the time of the battle. They're massaging the state of the diplomacy. They're massaging the, are you going to pay in rubles? Are we going to let you pay in euros until we phase out into rubles? Are we going to turn the gas off now? Oh, you're calling it a great reset. Oh, you're prepared for everyone to stop eating. Okay. They're just holding too many cards and they did too much prep work. Talking about the Russians. Okay. But from the point of view of the Azovstal guys, the Russians are not. They're just like a non-existing massive plot device that just moves the plot forward. In the minds of the Azovstal guys, like, this is about them. They have autobiographies to write about being stuck at Azovstal. Like, why in the hell are you going to ruin this movie, Russia, by not understanding that the good guys always win? Like, there's always a deus ex machina that comes in. There's going to be a boat. There's going to be a helicopter. You know what I mean? there's going to be like the last lines they say at the end of the movie is the helicopter or the boat goes off into the sunset and the Black Sea. Like, man, good thing we got the hell out of there. That's right, homie. Like, what were they what were they thinking this is supposed to go down? Like, they thought they were going to have this whole time. They were going to have all this time. They were going to have, like, Russia laying siege to the city. It was going to be the Azov guys were going to become the White Helmets. It was going to be all the damage that you see Russia doing. It was supposed to be, like, stretched out over more time. And there was going to be camera crews from, like, CNN and DW, France 24. And they were all going to be there. There was going to be, like, the OSCE and the UN people running around, like, doing whatever humanitarian shit. And then there was going to be the Azov battalion rebranded as, like, a White Helmets outfit. And they were going to show them, like, saving the people from the rubble. But it just, the plan got fucked up. Russia went in too fast. They were able to evacuate people into territory that at the very, that is at the very best argument that Ukraine could make is that it's enemy occupied territory, but that it's the territory of Ukraine. What if these people want to go somewhere else? I think it's a very tricky situation, but people got out of Mariupol and they didn't, not all of them went in deeper into, you know, westward into Ukraine. A lot of them went eastward into, you know, Donetsk Republic. Ukraine can't say that they were taken to a foreign country. How does that work in international law? How does that work out? Well, civilians are supposed to be what's called protected persons. Okay. The Geneva Diplomatic Conference for the Establishment of International Conventions for the Protection of Victims of War, signed in 1949, okay, they have to be treated humanely. And they can't be tortured. And they can't be used as hostages or degraded. Okay. But parties of a conflict, Russia being one of them, can make provisions for the well-being of the persons who live in an area which they declare to be under their occupation. And the people can live. It's supposed to be whatever they want. They can, they're not supposed to be stuck there unless they are a spy or a saboteur or a person under a specific suspicion of activity hostile to the security of the occupying power. Now, other than that, they can go where they want. Now, if they are in immediate need, so you're talking about a war zone, okay? We're talking about the 100,000, 200, 300,000, whatever, civilians who went, left from Mariupol and went into the Russian territory of one kind or another, occupied territory, Donetsk Republic, whatever you want to call it, into Russia, Rostov, whatever. People went different places. Keep in mind that until ethnic cleansing began in 2014, half of the population of Mariupol consider themselves that Russian language, no, sorry, identified as ethnic Russian. Now, more like two-thirds or three-fourths of the population before 2010 considered Russian to be the language that they spoke at home. That's why we've always tried to distinct, we haven't tried to make this be about ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians, because there are Ukrainians who identify as Ukrainian, but their more default language is Russian. And over time, that's also been something of a political statement. So they wouldn't call themselves Ukrainian, but they like Russia. They spoke Russian at home growing up. You know, the ones who didn't, you know, learned all the local slangs of different Ukrainians to fit in with who, you know, who their friends were, if they politically or socially, you know, were disinclined to be like pro-Russian or perceived that way. It's a complex society. But Mariupol, you had, if I recall correctly, you had like about 46-47% ethnic Ukrainians and 46-47% ethnic Russians, okay? Now, over the past 8 years, some 50 to 70,000 of those Russians have disappeared. Mostly moved away, we hope, we think, we, you know. But that's very hard. So the population's a little, going into the conflict, is a little bit lower than it had been. So it's now well below 500,000. It's something more like 420,000. But now, Ukrainians did have some humanitarian corridor that they allowed some people out, but people knew better, or people tried to know better, if they were going to be suspected of being pro-Russian or something, it was just much better to take the chances. Like, people would rather go over with the Russians, even if they were going to be somehow thought that they might not fit in as perfectly or pass muster, I should say, because they understand, people in the, people on the ground know what's going on. Am I clear about that? Like, people on the ground know that there's no accountability with these Ukrainians. You have like different death squads. You have these semi-autonomous Nazi volunteer battalions, brigades, whatever. And they have this mentality that this is war and sacrifices had to be made, and it's better to kill one innocent person than to let one saboteur through that's going to do whatever. Whereas they know the Russians are more just bureaucratic, more formalistic. They're not crazy about this. They're not Nazis. So it was a much better option just to go to try to exit the Russian way out of Mariupol. Now, Ukrainians lost their shit over this. This wasn't supposed to happen. Everything was supposed to be trying to make it be like Syria, like with Aleppo. Now, just to briefly explain, is Ukrainian a language? Is it okay? How different? Look, it's like the way it's been explained to me, and if you understand, language is a political division. Okay, Ukrainian is more like there's different Ukrainians. Okay, there's an Eastern Ukrainian and Central Ukrainian, which is basically Russian with a lot of these Ukrainian words in there. And then there's a Western Ukrainian, which is basically Polish with a Russian accent or a Ukrainian accent. And there's different types of pigeons in between Russian and these different gradations of Ukraine. There's like two or three major ones. If people speak slowly enough, I'm sure there's high degrees of interintelligibility. But that trying to decide if it's a language or a dialect is a stupid thing, because those are categorically value judgments that are not applied universally throughout language. I'll give you the best example, Arabic. Okay, if you speak Chaldean Arabic, well, you can communicate with Levantine Arabs, okay? Now, you speak with Egyptians, okay, then it gets a little bit okay. And then the far you go, you know, deeper into the Maghreb, North Africa, those Arabics don't make a lick of sense to you if you speak Chaldean Arabic, right? Like Iraqi and Syrian Arabic. It's like, imagine you're an American English speaker and you're speaking to like an Irishman on methamphetamine. You have a very difficult time, you see. So, but anyhow, we're talking about the mentality of the guys at Azov. They weren't supposed to lose. They were built up as the guys who win. They're there with NATO advisors. They're there with these NATO advisors, and the advisors are telling them, there's no way we're going to go down. There's no way that, you know, we're not going to get out of this. This is too important, too symbolic. And they just couldn't wing it. It just didn't work out for them. I think they just have to be desperate enough with the food. How does that go down? Is it going to be like cannibalism and shit? I think it's awesome that Russia's not pausing this conflict over them. They're like, okay, this area is surrounded. You can't get out. That's blockaded. But now we're starting to rebuild and open up schools. I think like school number 54, like last week, like they showed the kids go, I love Russian propaganda. It's so old school. It's so direct. There's no nuance at all. It's like, now the children have returned to school. So there they are. Stuck. Stuck. Stuck there at Azovstal. All they have to do is surrender. Just think about that. It's totally insane. It's totally insane that all they have to do is surrender. And yet that's the one thing that they can't do. The analogy to Dunkirk is a stupid analogy. Such a mess. Now, on Easter, Kalina revealed, if your eyes work, if you understand how language is used, he wanted a special Easter gift given to them . But he revealed that he doesn't believe in Easter. And it was very, very interesting wording. If you look at their address from Easter, Kalina says, that's like the Azov sub-commander there, he says, they say that Easter is blah, 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 blah. He never says, on this Easter we joined da-da-da, or Easter on this high holy day. No, none of those things came out of his mouth. He was pointing out that they don't believe in their beliefs. He was being hypocritical, which is a very typical. He was pointing out their He was being cynical about the alleged hypocrisy of his Christian opponents. That's a very common kind of thing. People are not Christians for cynical reasons. These Christians say that this is a day. That's what he said. They say that Easter is blah 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 blah. He never once said anything like, on this day. Of course, he didn't say Christ is risen. But, you know, that's maybe too specific to say on Easter. I don't know. You don't want to offend the ISIS guys they have with him, I guess. But how can this go on? And so when I was talking about this with Patrick Henningsen, we were trying to game it out. This was about, you know, 6 or 7 days ago. We were like, what, you know, how does this come together? And I think after a certain amount of time, people turn against you. People will learn, you know, this is what we were saying. There's the lie that the Russians won't let us surrender, but then it's actually kind of more clear now that the Russians are pausing all of this so that they can surrender. And the more they pause, the more people learn that it's the Azov guys that are lying about what the conditions are. So even though they talk about, oh, we're running out of food or running out of medicine, people are going, yeah, but actually you can surrender. And that attitude is growing. So things are not good for them. Like, as they become more desperate, the public at the same time is getting fed up with them. I'll tell you an interesting thing about the public, because the public will fucking turn on you. The public hates to be frustrated. And the public wants to support things that they think will win. And it's like how voters, like American voters up until the last couple of elections, because they were very decisive. But historically, there was back before when elections were more middle of the road and the issues were less intense, people would just lie about who they voted for and say they voted for the guy who won, who was the president. It was the path of least resistance and just a normal way to get along. And also kind of you internalize, like, fuck losers, you know, like, people support. That's why in push poll, like, you know what push polling is? Like, if someone is so far ahead, like 10 points ahead, they pick up like 4 more points just from people that only want to support the one who's going to win. Isn't that interesting? So the public eventually turns against Azov. Also, there was all this tension that was building and building, like this crescendo of attention on it. And then like the Russians are killing interest in it just by having it drag out. They're like, we'll play the information war. Like, you're bored of this. Like, you won't even, we'll go and we'll fucking just bomb the place or gas the place eventually, or they'll just starve. But people will have forgotten about, right? Now, there are, as we have said, very likely some important advisors there. People who, the French is a likely scenario. But I think there's, as we were talking about, I think this goes deeper than that. There's something going on there. But I think their egos are a big part of it. I think that, I don't think that they've made some type of a monkey human hybrid, or I don't think they have like experiments with brains outside of bodies and shit, or I don't think it's like, I don't think they have a, the coronavirus 2.0 down there, or airborne AIDS. I don't think they have that down there. But I do think they're sitting on a giant heap of entitlement. They're massively suffering from main character syndrome. It's just, I think it's just a situation that they were so convinced that they're on the winning side. Their whole belief system is that we're going to get it right. And while there may be all kinds of incriminating things there, that can't be destroyed. I mean, you have things that can be destroyed, but there's people. I think it's got to be the people, because everything else by now you can destroy. There's nothing there. I mean, could it be some data that they can't transfer somewhere, but they can't destroy it because it's got to get back into the right hands. I suppose it's not impossible, but you know, and I can't say what's likely or not likely, but just the way I have it in my mind is that it's the people themselves. It's the people themselves that who are there in Azovstal. They've got nowhere to go. the Russians were not supposed to take this city so fast. God, you just put yourself in their shoes. Just think about that. It's amazing. Now they're marrying the girls that they've abducted. They're having gay sex. They're figuring out, like, do they have freezers down there? I guess the power, do they have generators? They have fuel? I mean, you imagine they could have all kinds of things like that. If someone dies, is that food? Now, this is a part that we didn't touch on yet. Part of their big mand that they're making is that they be extracted to a third-party country. And they could be very mad at Zelensky for any number of reasons. These people never liked him in the first place. The hardcore Azov guys, they don't see Zelensky as their leader. Just to understand, I think this is basically understood by most people, but just for people kind of, because, you know, here we are in season 8 and maybe you're only into season 2 or 3 so far, but it's enough that you can listen to the stuff about from season 8 without being totally lost. But just so you understand, a lot of people voted for Zelensky, but the Nazis actually didn't really vote for Zelensky. They don't really like him. The Nazis actually don't like Zelensky. Now, he likes them because they're minions or tools towards how he can manage and stuff, but he's in deep trouble with them. I mean, they understand on a certain level that he's not in control of anything, but they just don't like him. There's a lot of reasons that they don't like him. They don't even like Poroshenko. But they like Poroshenko better than they like Zelensky. Zelensky was like a psychological operation that was played upon the public. In lieu of fulfilling the Minsk agreement, he talked peace. And a lot of people who legitimately were Party of Regions voters Yanukovych voters, the guy who was overthrown in 2014. Okay. Basically, the people from the east of the country and the south of the country. Okay. A lot of those voters voted for Zelensky. And they knew that a lot of the Nazis did not like Zelensky, which made him a lot more credible as a candidate. Okay. Now, we're not suggesting that Zelensky's in charge or blah, 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 blah. But, you know, there's a lot of drama involved, too. In a country like Ukraine, everyone knows who the president's bodyguards are. You have to understand these countries. All these Slavic countries, the public knows who the bodyguards of the president are because a lot of times they come from their either football club leaders who are also special forces that are intelligence related or the mafia and all combined, like football clubs, mafia, special forces. Okay. And there's always this drama between them and drug deals and corruption and stuff like this and involved with females like singers and stuff, like local celebrities and stuff, these like local prostitutes, basically. I mean, no hatred, no judgment, you know. I love them all, but I'm just saying, you know, the altered profession. So, they're very mad. Very mad. And they don't really think that that Zelensky has any solutions for Ukraine. As we talked about a month ago or 2 months ago when this conflict started, I think we explained it then, but we're filling people in. I don't think we were recording these back then. So this is important, I guess, to document for the record. We said this at the time. Azov believes that by defeating Russia in the battlefield, that the rest of Europe goes like super far right, like that Nazism gets revived in Europe. They'll see that you can't defeat Russia if you have, you know, multiculturalism, if you have a migration, overabundance of migrants, or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase that, more immigrants than some section of the population might otherwise prefer not to have, or might prefer to have. So think about that. They actually, their theory of how to achieve power was designed by the same thinkers that convinced ISIS that to destroy Israel, the best thing to do is to destroy Syria, not to attack Israel. Okay. That's how the Gladio B and ISIS, Al-Qaeda stuff, that's how they go formative at the level of leadership. They control, you know, these people, the cabal, and they get them thinking like backwards stuff. I mean, backwards stupid on top of stupid beliefs, but I mean, there's smart strategy for stupid beliefs, isn't there? But these are actually stupid strategies to achieve stupid beliefs, which are not, they don't necessarily go together. You can have stupid strategies to achieve smart beliefs. You could have, you know, smart strategies to achieve stupid beliefs, right? Okay. Setting aside that they're stupid beliefs, the strategy is really fucking dumb. In other words, they believe that they can take on Russia and its army and its corrupt oligarchy and its whole society. Okay. But they didn't have the ability to just split the Ukrainian army in half or raise an army the size of the Ukraine or defeat the Ukrainian army and go after the actual Ukrainian oligarchs. See, they could have just done that. See, that would have been a smart strategy to implement a stupid belief. Do you see what I'm saying? What they believe is that by defeating Russia, then people will see that. It's like what a stupid fucking, like whenever the step involves, everyone will see. It's like, oh, fuck you, dude. Like no one's going to see shit. Like we have to accomplish this impossible thing. And then we have to make sure that it's marketed. The thinking is that they thought, okay, we're going to attack Russia, and through our victories against Russia, because we're Nazis, and because we're Nazis, we're the only ones who know how to defeat Russia, because we kind of defeated Russia before, except we hit some, you know, bad weather and a few bad tactics. But other than that, the Wehrmacht was invincible. in their mind. They're all Werribus or Veribus. Do you know what a Veribu is? Does anybody not know what a can someone in the comments write out the definition of a Veribu? I know that they're Veribus because it is Veribu logic that, now get this, I'm going to come full circle for you. Okay. Only in Veribu land was the Battle of Dunkirk actually Hitler allowed the invincible Wehrmacht and then Hitler through his brotherly feelings didn't allow the invincible Wehrmacht to destroy this army that was trapped. Disregarding that they lost 258 planes, extra, you know, X amount of soldiers, X amount, et cetera, in a very serious battle for Dunkirk, which at the end, the Anglo-French forces were able to arrange a naval, but they had to defend it very heavily. They lost 60,000, you know, hundreds of planes, hundreds of artillery pieces, hundreds and hundreds of many things to save, you know, 330,000 soldiers out of 400,000 or something like this. Okay. But it's a Veribu mythology that Hitler's Wehrmacht was so indestructible that there's no way that this only happened because Hitler let them leave. Just like Putin should let Azov leave. That's why Volyn makes this false historical. It's false for several reasons. Number one, it didn't happen that way. Okay. A Veribu is a person on the internet who argues on forums or on Reddit that despite being destroyed by the Red Army, that the Wehrmacht was indestructible and probably should have won World War II. And it was really just a short list series of unfortunate circumstances and just offhand or off chance, sort of whatever you call it, just kind of pushed things the other way. But really, the Wehrmacht would have won. Also, this is going to sound really funny. This is going to sound really, really funny. Okay. A lot of these Ukrainian guys who are Nazis, of course they have the internet, okay? But the thing is that people tend to project onto broader societies that people actually agree with them. Like they imagine that people agree with them in broader numbers than they really do. Okay. It's a type of projection. And in the minds of these Ukrainian Nazis, they think that Europe is much more pro-Nazi than it really is. And I don't mean, oh, by some the same companies, and not like an economic analysis of the financial backings of Nazism or something like that. No. Just among regular everyday people, they have a false sense of where people are at in their heads. They have a false consensus paradigm in their heads about what Europeans think. So they think that this transformation for Europe is the easy part. They think they just have to defeat Russia. It's the same thing with ISIS, and it's the same fingerprint of these stupid ideologues that are handpicked I mean, stupid good, because it puts them into things they can't win, but they're just stupid tactics from their stupid thinking from the beginning. Am I making sense? They don't have the ability to overthrow their own oligarchy. They don't have the ability to put like a right sector guy as the president of the country. They just have no idea how stupid it actually sounds because they're trapped up in it. And you know the way organizations work. You kind of get recruited into it. You're kind of, your friends are in it, play pool, whatever, football, club. You have these guys that are kind of more popular. They're more well-known. Maybe more on the steroids, more popular. And, you know, you're 18, 21-year-old kid. You're just happy to be invited, you know, in the clubs, in the meetings. And you're like, wow, this is serious shit. These guys have been in the war. Like, they've seen crazy things because this is the year 2022 now. So a lot of these kids that would join weren't even old enough to, you know, when all the crazy stuff happened. I'm going to help some people out here. I don't know if that's a good link or not. There's a lot of good Wearaboo memes out there. So that's your story. That's your bedtime story. Azov trapped. And now there's continued information war. Now the UN, this is where we're building up to this. This is very important. Very, very important, okay? The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is mobilizing a team to coordinate the evacuation of civilians from the Azovstal steel complex right there. Now, if you were to read that, you would think that this is in connection with something. I'm going to try to explain another dynamic of how this bullshittery works in the world. I know that these can be at first difficult, but I relate these back down to your personal experiences with people that you've had, perhaps. I hope not, but most probably you have. And then you can work out how this gaslighting and insanity is plausible, like how they think that this, okay, like, have you ever had anybody pre-sell you or like presume the sale? you know, like when you've been somewhere to buy, maybe you're just kind of shopping and you're just looking and the person starts saying like, oh, can I wrap that for you? Or, oh, were you going to charge this or were you going to, you know, do you have paying cash? I think you said cash because I think I can, you know, make this note, you know, tax free. And you're like, I never said any of this. Like, I didn't say I wanted to buy this shit, dude. Okay. Or, and then they throw back at you, like they start guilt tripping you, like, but you came in, you said you were looking, and then, but we do have the thing that you said you wanted. You know, I said I could order it, but you said, no, this is the one. And then I think, you know, you mentioned cash. No, I said I didn't have my wallet. Right, you said you didn't have cash, but, you know, we can give credit or you can just sign an IOU or just leave your keys and come back and buy it. Okay. This is what they're trying to do again. I know this sounds funny, but this is exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to presume that there's a deal that they're going to get out alive. See, they're just trying to conjure that positive energy into the universe. We're going to get out of this alive. Of course we're being evac'd, extracted. Of course we are. Like, we're entitled to it. Everyone, if we just keep up that belief that we are, then people will just melt to the side of this belief. They'll be like, oh, right, of course, that's the prince. Oh, of course, the emperor's robes are fantastic. Like, of course, like, yes. Can I offer you a refund? Okay. What they're doing is this. Like, Putin paused the assault on Azovstal and called it canceled, even though, as we explained, nothing is canceled. It's not like they didn't send the dress back, cancel the caterers. You know what I mean? It's not like a canceled wedding. Like, the army is still there. You see, they're manifesting this reality and they're baiting you into their own world of insanity. And if you believe it with them, then you'll start to think that when Putin offered opening of the humanitarian corridor, and then when Putin met with the head of the UN and said Bucha was a hoax, but we're still offering to allow these Azovstal guys to surrender, and we're providing humanitarian corridor for the civilians who are not the soldiers. Okay, those were official statements that were reiterated just yesterday. So then the games are that because the cabal has much influence over these different UN committees and actually over the Secretary General, as you can see. Okay. And now what they're doing is they're trying to attach the humanitarian corridor that Putin and that we all know has been there for a long time, like, right? We know that they can leave. The civilians can leave. The soldiers have to surrender, okay? But what the cabal is trying to do is create a new word called people. It's an old word, but it applies in a new, fresh way, which means that, you know, all the people there are trapped. man, they're all people. What, you're going to start, oh, this one's a woman, this one's a soldier, so what are you trying to say, that women can't be soldiers, or are you a sexist, or... So what they're doing, what the cabal is doing, what these Azov guys are hoping and manifesting here is that they're making it look like what the UN is doing over here and what Putin said over there are somehow connected. And then they're setting it up just like when the person assumes the sale and they start wrapping the thing, like you haven't bought the thing. They start wrapping it for you and going through the, telling the guy in the back, oh, hey, we're out of wrapping paper. Oh, I'll run back to the store. Like all this effort to put the sale together for you, and because they're closing you. They're closing you through the effort of closing you is actually what closes you on the deal. And likewise, the UN is announced in the aftermath of this meeting with Putin. I hope this is making sense to you, what I'm saying. In the aftermath of this UN Secretary General meeting with Putin, even though Putin just said the regular things that we already know how to interpret what he said, when he says we've created a humanitarian corridor, when he says the soldiers are free to surrender, but they're not free to go fucking free, right? But they're free to surrender or, you know, die. Or die starving, try not to die. But they're actually going to gaslight you, okay, into that the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is acting as if something has given them the green light to go ahead to mobilize a team to coordinate the evacuation of civilians. But this is not at all what's been agreed to, because there's no such person as a citizen of the UN. They have to fucking come from somewhere. So then it just becomes a pretext to insert, well, don't they need security? Yeah, they only need like 600, you know, special forces people. Where would they come from? Well, you know, from the international community. Some from Israel, from Japan, you know, Germany, United States, Canada, all the countries, Australia, New Zealand, UK, everyone will be there. It'll, you know, international community, a bunch of neutral countries, Canada, Micronesia, Guam, Puerto Rico, all the independent countries. It's not just about the U.S. They're going to have to be there too. That's what the UN imagines that they're doing. And then they're going to act like, oh, so Putin's backing out of the humanitarian corridor. Dude, I thought we had a deal. Dude, what do you mean? I wrapped the thing. I got the discount. The manager said he'll give it for 20% off. I called my uncle over to get more stuff from across the street for you. We stayed open an extra 30 minutes. We were supposed to close half an hour ago. Dude, I kept the drawer open. I told, it's my mom's birthday. I'm late for her surprise party. Do we have a deal or not? Dude, Putin, you said that you opened up a humanitarian corridor, dude. And then you met with the UN and you said it again. And after you met with the UN, dude, then the UN put together the whole committee to make it happen. No wonder the Russians can't be trusted. I guess it makes sense. Their word, you know, their word means nothing. Putin's just a liar. If you think about it like that, because he agreed to a humanitarian corridor, he met with the UN, and then the UN, after the meeting, put together a committee to coordinate that all the people will get out. And maybe those soldiers, too, deserve it by now. I mean, they're trapped there, too. I mean, they're, in a sense, they're honorary civilians. I mean, what? I mean, they do all the things that civilians do. I mean, what's the difference? Because some identify as the gun holders, some identify as child bearers, some identify as lactators, some identify as old, some identify as young, but they can change. They're free to change these. You know, they call themselves soldiers. They're the ones empowered to define themselves. They have the right to redefine themselves. You can't just lock them into an identity. That's very oppressive. In fact, it's the Russians that are the fucking Nazis, because they're trying to say who's a fucking soldier and who's just a person. And we got to let the people out, man. I mean, what is that, being a soldier? Is that a life sentence? Can't you quit? What if they all say we quit? Or what if they promise to quit? What if they say, hey, as soon as we get out, we promise to quit Azov. As soon as we get out, we promise we'll bring our guns to one of them, you know, gun exchanges, where you get those like vouchers for Walmart. They're just people, man. It's going to be a war crime to kill them at this point. At this point, it's going to be, after all this expectation that we had that they're going to get out, are the Russians really going to do us like that? That shit ain't right. I mean, they let us believe that there was a way that they could get out. Now, I know they said surrender, but haven't they already surrendered their hearts? Haven't they already kind of surrendered their dignity? I mean, I saw him big manding there. I saw Volin big manding. So you can see how this works in the mind. You can see how that. I think someone was even convinced that I was being. I think someone was like commenting that I lost my mind. No. No, no, no. I lost my mind a long time ago. What we're talking about today is that this is the psychological game that's going on. We're just going deep into the mind of the target audience. We're just going deep into the minds of the target audience of this gaslighting and this, you know, these mind games that the cabal plays, and what you're seeing, you know, telegraphed through the mouths of Kalina and Volin. Yeah, it's like we're being too hard on them, dude. They're all there. They're all there fucking jacked up. They're like, ugh. They've got ammunition to last for another 3 weeks. They're running out of food. You know, they want you to, we've suffered enough, guys. We've suffered enough. And so what they're saying is that the Russians don't have a good history of keeping their word with ceasefires and humanitarian corridors. That's what their stats is, literally what they have said. I'm not inventing that. That was just said recently as a reason why Ukraine does not accept that the guys in Azov could surrender. So that's our the third party country, probably Turkey, just in the scheme of things. They propose that as the most credible neutral country. And I think in all reality, it's not, there's no such thing as a neutral country, right? But in reality, Turkey does have a very strong degree of sovereignty in its decision-making process. Surprisingly so, given its, you know, existence inside of NATO, but not that strong of one. How far are they going to take this? What do you think? They're waiting for a, like, there's, it's like, this is a great setup, right? Because with each passing day, the public kind of loses focus of them and starts to turn on them, because that's how publics work. Even if they really are the victim, this is how the public works. And this is a really horrible thing about mass psychology, like the crowd, right? Like the crowd people talk about. But if there's no way that the victim can succeed, like even if they really are the victim, like this whole, come on, hey, dude, come on. We've already surrendered our hearts. Even if that's convincing, and they are working really hard at, you know, making you forget that they can surrender, what they actually, with each passing day, people start to turn on them. Because what people do, this is just a bad thing about humanity, right? People will start to blame the victims. And in this particular instance, when people do that, they will be right. Because what they will say, what people are starting to say is, fuck these chumps. They could just surrender. Why don't they just surrender? And the word is going to get out there that they could surrender. It's just that the truth is still putting its pants on when the lie is already halfway around the world. And the truth that they could surrender at any time, they could, and that they could let all those civilians out first or last or in between or every other or duck, duck, goose or whatever they want to do. All those civilians could get out. People are going to realize that. They're going to realize that even though it's a shame, and even though there's egg on their face, and even though maybe the Russians can't be trusted, there's no way, by the way, that you can have this thing televised. I was talking to a friend of mine, very smart guy, about this stuff. And he says, you know, what the Russians could do is just make an agreement with the UN about having UN observers there, but only people with no military background, that Russia has to agree to who from the UN comes, and it's mostly camera crews to make sure that the Russians don't shoot people or do the things that the Ukrainians think or accuse Russians of doing or whatever. And I said to my friend, I said, dude, like, that's a good idea, but you know what Azov is just going to do? They're going to start a firefight, and they're going to start shooting people in the back and start shooting through people at the Russians. And the Russians are going to have to shoot back, and the civilians are going to get caught in the crossfire, and it's going to get reported or viewed like the Russians started shooting. There's really no way to do this. If anyone's going to be watching, they actually, Azov has a greater incentive to do it like that if there's people watching, if there's cameras there. You actually can't have that stuff there. There can be no audience for this stuff. Then if they get out, they get out. If the civilians get killed, then Azov killed them. Or they never left. Even if they did, they never did, because no one's there. The Russians will just tell the story that makes sense to tell, that people understand. And there'll be no one to contradict that, because the worst type of lie that you're going to get out of Azovstal is a camera lying, right? Because it edit, or the camera angles, or the selective editing, it's going to look like the Russians started shooting first. Just use your brains, like how this scenario goes down all the time, right? Learn everything you learned from Syria. Bring that into the equation. So the Azov guys go hungry. So what we're saying is that with each passing day, the people start to turn against Azov. And the thing is this. Here's the crazy thing. This isn't guesswork. Twitter, Instagram, or Meta, you know, Facebook, what's up? Instagram, Twitter. Okay, all of these apps are, as we learned about through U.S. congressional hearings, are plugged in to a single coordinating program with Google, Alphabet, I should include, YouTube, okay? And they share information, okay? What they can do anyway with their data, right, with their is, and they can define, they're not just pulling words out. They interpret meaning. They have their AI pulls out the meaning of people's conversations and what people are talking about. They're going to know exactly when the public is turning against these Azov guys. If you want to know how these Azov guys have communication, internet to the outside world, We know this because they're constantly fucking talking to Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, the Ukrainian version. It's called Radio Svoboda. Svoboda. Svoboda Radio. Like Svoboda Party, the Nazi Party. The first one. So they're talking to them all the time. It's on YouTube where you're allowed to be a Nazi if you're a Ukrainian Nazi. Because it's literally Voice of America. It's literally Voice of America. It's literally Radio Free Europe. They literally financed and funded them. When we showed the Nazi mercenary training camp that got blown up, like 160 of them died. Okay. You know that the International Brigade for Ukraine is actually financed through this thing directly from Sweden, Canada, the US, AID. It's all, we shared all the website, we took screenshots, we gave the links. We did that like 2 months ago or whenever this thing got blowed up. I know the word is blown, it's just funnier to say blowed. When it got blowed up in, what was it, March 11th or March 5th or whatever that was. It was like really early on in the conflict. Remember all those reports that mercenaries are like, don't come. They'll give you 10 bullets and send you to the front. This is awful. Then they were acting like they were turning people down. They weren't turning people down. They only turn people down who could be obviously infiltrators or something like that. They do background check, like, to an extent, but they weren't turning people down. They weren't like, oh, we've turned down. They needed everybody they could get. The same military that is pressing 65-year-olds, like clearly you can see, or busloads of 15-year-olds into their second round of recruitment is not turning down 20 to 35 year olds with prior military experience of any kind. The requirement that they have combat experience is a bullshit. You can sniff the bullshit from miles away. Just look at who they're forcing in. Look at the Ukrainians that they're forcing into the army now. Now, I know a lot of them look like methamphetamine addicts now, but I think that's all the Captagon that they've been on for a couple months now. It's really bad on the immune system and it like hollows you out. It's very bad. If you ever seen like Faces of Meth, that's basically what Captagon is. It's methamphetamine with some other thing that I don't know what it trick. I don't know my drugs very well, but it's like an upper. But then there's some painkiller in it that makes you feel at ease. So maybe there's some pseudo-opioid in there as well. So maybe there's just kind of like an opioid and a amphetamine combined, something like that. Anyway, Captagon. Totally amped up. So guys on Captagon can have serious wounds and carry on like without, as if they didn't. That's pretty nuts, right? I think it's pretty nuts, but they're letting everyone in that they can get in at this point in time. And the whole scheme that they were going to have this giant army of 900,000 reserves was a lie that the head of the Ukrainian military was kind of like propelled into this big lie with the British, because the US and the UK were going to use the Great Reset, the threat of the Great Reset against Europe to allow Ukraine into NATO, except they weren't. it was never going to happen. But they used that story to convince the Ukrainians, at a certain level of Ukrainians who need to believe a lie and don't need to be the ones lying, right? Intentionally. Organizations are complex. Just trying to explain how different people function in them. Countries are not people. There's millions of people. There's thousands of bureaucrats, different people, different motivations. Okay. They made it a credible, plausible thing that Ukraine could get into NATO very fast. And they were using that whole posture to get Ukraine up with these imaginary numbers. Now, at a certain point, I think that they thought that they were going to get the Russians to move in, but the Russians were not going to be able to move in, except maybe in a way similar to what they were accused of doing before. But not even the OSCE would say that the Russians were moving in a lot of artillery or people into the Donbas. This was like North Wind, people used to call it. Magical North Wind. I mean, you had like Volant Corps, Volant Org, you had mercenary, you had a lot of soldiers receive, like a lot of Russian soldiers got leave. And then they went to volunteer in the Donbas. A lot of weapons and things were not brought in from Russia all the time, but they were purchased from Ukrainian side. Now, there was a certain point when there was like the humanitarian caravans were coming in, like the big, like the whole, like many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of multiple ton five-wheel trucks, like with the big trailers on them, were coming in. And for sure, there was, you know, weapons and stuff on those. The Russians have gotten weapons into Donbas and things like that. But the bigger, heavier pieces, like tanks and things like that, a lot of these were just trophies or were bought on the battlefield. They were given, bought. There was a lot of corruption in Ukraine, a lot of lack of, you know. No one believes that you're going to defeat Russia. Like, no one in his right fucking mind in Ukraine that isn't wrapped up in this crazy Nazi stuff, like, really thinks that that's how this thing goes down in the end. The thing that I would tell, like what Ukrainians are talking, it's like, you fucking retards, you can become a Nazi, but you're never going to be considered an Anglo-Saxon. You're never going to be considered an Anglo. You can get a Nazi tattoo. You can have blue eyes and blonde hair. You can learn to speak German. You're never going to be white in that narrow late 19th, early 20th century definition of the word. You know, before the Irish were white, before Greeks could ever call themselves white in America or the Italians. The definition of white is a very small. It's a very small, you know, the French aren't really white, you know. They're very swarthy, in fact. Many Germans are swarthier than they ought to be, considering how much they had to insist on their whiteness. They actually were kind of excluded from the white club themselves for a while, the Germans. In fact, German immigrants in America used to call themselves Dutch, because even Germans were considered to be like a different type of, I know this is weird, okay? You had Slavs, Huns, and Germans. And those were all considered like Eastern people. Yeah, the, you know, Germans, Huns, Slavs, they were all considered like more, you know, distant, beyond the forested fog and plains, these other people, the Germans. So in America, the Germans, to be polite, call themselves Dutch. That's where you get the Pennsylvania Dutch from. It's actually a polite word for German, because being German is impolite. It's not white. And there's no more such thing. There are no more of a polite people than the Anglo-Saxons are the most polite people, according to themselves. And the Germans just aren't, the Germans weren't considered. Here's a plot twist. Okay. It's very similar to the Ukrainians. Okay. A lot of the German Nazism was a positive affirmation of an identity that the English and the Americans were denying them. Like the fixation on the genetics and everything like that. Isn't that fascinating? Okay. So, Ukrainians will never be considered part of the club. They've got to be, I mean, even the ones who believed in the lie for a while, they've got to be waking up, like, from this stupid dream that's become a nightmare and a war in their own country. Yes, they were manipulated, but they were flattered into the manipulation. They weren't coerced. They were flattered. In that sense, they brought it upon themselves. It's a horrible thing. We will consider you European. They should have known right away. See, everything can be boiled down to what everything that you learned from romantic situations. If the person has to harm themselves or do something crazy to prove that they love you, then the person making those demands doesn't really love you. And the reason that among the Anglo-Saxons, among themselves, they view their own lives to be very valuable. I mean, sure, if you're poor, you can go to the army and die for the democracy or for the king or whatever. But they consider their own losses, you know, like when a white girl is missing, they consider their own losses like a very terrible thing. So the Ukrainian should have, like, the bullshit meter should have gone off right away. And they're like, just go fight in a war against Russia. It's like, oh my God. And then you'll, like, have earned this European, just be totally anti-Russia to the point of suicide, collective suicide. And then you'll earn this love from us. And that's not how love works. That's not how being European works. Europeans don't have to prove that they're Europeans by suicide. It's like Ukrainians are like a black girl with an abusive boyfriend who's like, bleach your skin, put blue contacts, straighten your hair. It's like, dude, she's black. Dude, they're Slavs. You're never going to be part of the club. Now, the collective, I'm trying to deconstruct the collective psychosis or the social psychology of this sort of median, this fictional median Ukrainian, right, that we're trying to construct, this fictional median average slash median Ukrainian who, like, through their, they don't need to have an inferiority complex. Now, I have some criticisms of the Russians. They do think that their way is the right way, but doesn't anybody with any self-esteem think that their way is the right way? I mean, it's been working for them on the balance across 9 time zones over 400 years decently. Fair enough. Fair enough. And I can understand the Ukrainians not wanting to feel like they're Robin to Russia's Batman. You see what I'm saying? Like, they don't want to be like the, right? Now, because of their own internalized chauvinism, it's called auto-chauvinism, self-hatred. They actually believe the Europeans, when the Europeans think that Europeans are superior to Slavs. So if they could be the Robin to a European Batman, then that, but they're European, but kind of like a second rate, you know, kind of like Czechs. How Czechs kind of try to pretend that they're German when they travel abroad. Oops, did I say that out loud? They would rather be a second-rate European than a second-rate Russian, because in their minds, a second-rate European is still superior to a Russian. And that is their Nazism, you see? You see, Slavs are not Europeans. It's only in their own self-affirmation of their own self-culture. It's like, you know, what, yes, there are Slovak and Czech moms and dads who tell their sons, we're Europeans. And, but you're not. I mean, not in the eyes of the Germans. Or the Dutch, or the Swedes, or the Swiss, or the French, or the English. You're just kind of like a group of Russians that somehow wound up living just a little bit uncomfortably too far west. But that's okay, because we'll just make sure that you have little microstates that can never rise a real challenge to the European powers. Even Czechoslovakia had to become Slovakia and Czechia. It's called Czechia now. I'm just giving you the no bullshit, like how this works. This is just how this works. There's, you know, in the social anthropology of the Western European mind, yes, you can see in Prague, you know, 17th and 18th century architecture, and it resembles things that Europeans built. It resembles things that Europeans built. It was highly influenced by European culture, you see. But you're just a bunch of goulash eating backwards, superstitious folks, and your grandmas all wear babushkas at the end of the day. I mean, the real competitors in time for the crown of the Slavic world, it went back and forth between Russia and Poland, actually, for a long time. It was kind of like, what's the center of Slavorum? You know, Slavorum. Is it Poland? Or like the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, right? Or is it Russia, right? I mean, Poland imposed... put a czar on the throne in Moscow, in the name of Poland, right? So there's a lot of things in the mentality. You know, Poles consider Slovakian to be like a dialect of Polish that's spoken badly. Yeah, neo-Nazi movements have tried to broaden the definition of white. A lot of that comes from the U.S. and it's imposed like in the 80s and 90s and stuff. There's a lot of different third position theorists about what a European is, and trying to conflate whiteness with Europeanness, you know, and that has worked to a certain extent, but only in the direction of including France, Belgium, Luxembourg into the definition of white. That's what has been like. Well, the Belgians, the Luxembourgians, and the French are also white. You see? There's definitely a ranking system of whiteness. And the funny thing is that the Ukrainians don't fit into that anywhere. They don't. And again, the proof is, what did Europe demand of Ukraine to prove? Just like, imagine you're the black girl and you're trying to join like the all white cheerleading squad. And they're like, okay, Lavonica, Shaniqua, change your name to Stacy, start bleaching your skin, drop the Ebonics, get some blue contact lenses, get a nose job, straighten your hair and bleach it, and then come to the tryouts. And then come to the tryouts. That's what they're doing to Ukraine right now. That's what they're doing. It's awful. I feel so bad for Ukrainians that are being put through this. And it's just... it's like you're a Salvadoran trying to claim that you're Spanish to get one up on a Mexican because it's better to be Spanish than Mexican in the mind of a Salvadoran who feels that it's worse to be Salvadoran than Mexican. Does that make sense? Which I'm really helping to untangle this mentality of how it works. And I said, this is like a non-existent person, yet it's like the average or median unexpressed vibrational thought that courses through Ukrainians about these questions. I know it sounds bizarre when you I know it sounds bizarre at first, like when you think about it like that. But that's the sting. So very sad. I hope that Ukrainians, you know, look, there's a very, if you kind of had Poland, if Poland had some ability to have something with Lithuania, you know, Latvia, Estonia, right? I mean, let's just hypothetically, this is almost useless, but I'm just saying, okay. Ukraine, if it wasn't run by an oligarchy bent on selling off all the resources and underpaying the labor, but actually had a serious approach like Russia does. And if Poland also had some less of the same problems that Ukraine has, Ukraine, Poland, you know, Poland hyphen Lithuania and Russia would be very almost like co-equal. I mean, Russia's still like 9 time zones, nuclear weapons, we get it, right? But just economically, in terms of like the status, those three powers could be big enough that they dealt with each other on enough of co-respectful kind of like co-power terms that being a Ukrainian wouldn't be considered like a second-rate Russian or like a Russian who requires an extra, like everyone hates hyphenated identities. Like you don't want to have a hyphenated, you don't want to be like, well, I'm Ukrainian, we're Russian Ukrainian, or, you know, a lot of Ukrainians got tired of this. They'd be like, what is a Ukrainian? You know, a Russian? Yeah, okay, well, it's that, but Ukrainian. Oh, okay. I just think about Ukrainians traveling. I mean, Ukrainians live everywhere now, but a long time ago, like in the 90s and stuff, like people are like, what's a Ukrainian? It's like a Russian, but there's many Russias too. There are many different Russias inside of Russia. You know, the giveaway, I know this sounds weird, okay? But Europeans are not fixated on making a positive affirmation of their identity as Europeans. You know that you're dealing with a Czech or a Slovak or a Pole, if that is a big part of their identity. I know that sounds weird. But if they have to make positive affirmations of a European identity, like all the time, like, and I mean in the political discourse, like in the pundit class and the bloggers and the people on TV, like when you watch Czech or Slovak TV or Polish TV, like, you know, the Saturday morning shows, like, well, as Europeans, we blah, 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 blah. And it's constantly being reinforced. Like in France, they don't fucking say that. Ever. They never say that shit. They're French. They don't need to like generically sweep their Czechness under the rug of Europeanness. Does that make sense? It's like these EU people. So it's a very, very interesting situation that we have with our friends trapped at Azovstal. Very peculiar indeed. There's no way out. With each passing day, people start to blame them, even if they saw them truly as victims. They'll start to blame them. But this time, people will be right when they blame these non-victims. They'll start to say things like, well, you got yourself into this, or that's what you signed up for. Like, I already know what people think. This is what you signed up for. Well, you got yourself into this. No one told you not to surrender. You just somehow decided that wasn't an option before, which, you know, by definition closes off any real option. It's like, I want you to change the color of my house, but do not use paint. I'm very thirsty, but I cannot receive liquids. It's like, go fuck yourself, dude. I want to leave this place where you are trying to kill me, but I refuse to surrender. What? What is this? So here's the issue. So with each passing day, blah, 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 right? People turn on them. But with each passing day, there's some hope that there's going to be a false flag, that there's going to be some big thing happens. Basically a false flag. I mean, what are we going to list the number of things? Well, there could be a false flag. Let's see what else. Yeah, no diplomatic breakthroughs. That's not... I guess the Ukrainians could abduct another one of their own citizens. That once upon a time said something good about Putin or Russia. And then we could trade, and then we'll have Ukraine trading, you know, trying to trade for its own people again. God, what is this? So, that is where things can go. False flag. And I'm just curious what you guys think. Let me know what you think about this. Write me in these comments. Do they starve? Like, because you get hungry, right? Like, how is this structured? Who's got the gun pointed at who? Who's got the gun pointed at who? Like, there's guys there not letting him leave. There's guys there not letting them leave, right? At one point, do those guys lose control of that situation? Is it Volin? Is Volin not letting people leave? Is it Kalina? You know, the dude, the kind of fat dude with the spaghetti arms, but he aggroes you when he talks with his bottom teeth showing, so you think he's a badass. Like, everyone's a badass with a gun, right? Who's keeping him in there? Like, okay, fine. Like, it doesn't matter if people in Kiev are saying things, right? Because they are there and they could just surrender, right? But here's the crazy thing about this. And this is why we get back to this point. There's 300 to 400 mercenaries and they could just be executed. They are dead to rights. And it's deeper than that because of this. A lot of these NATO commanders and advisors are not actually there on official business in their capacity as whatever their rank and title is in the military, but instead they are there as through these private contracted security agencies, which makes them fucking mercenaries. So you imagine you have someone who's like a very high ranking somebody, not the guy who's the 3-star commander of the land forces of but lower than that, but still important. Like there's, it's not like just him and then everyone's a grunt. Like they're still important people, maybe some French important brass, but there's a very high probability that they are not there in their official capacity as a in their armed forces that they are in. There's a very high chance, because this is, we're not inventing how this works, like this is a thing, that they're working on their own time, private, you know, time, as a contractor, as a consultant, for, you know, some Eric Prince type outfit, right? And they're getting an extra $1 million or $10 million or whatever. And they ended up there. And it just blows my mind. I know it's just crazy because they really didn't think that the Russians would take Mariupol. That's what it comes down to. They wouldn't have been there. Like they had assurances it wasn't going to happen. They had assurances that they could hold it. I mean, they were armed up in there and entrenched in there. They were so hooked up with supplies and artillery and big pieces. They were so overflowing with weapons and support. I think they thought that the Russians just weren't going to deal with it head on, or they would lay siege to it. How could there be, because this, that we just worked through the logic of this, like, right, we're trying to work through it, right? Like, why won't they surrender? Is it just because there's people that in Kiev saying surrender? That doesn't make sense either, because they would say, well, fuck you in Kiev, we're going to surrender. And now we surrender to the Russians. Maybe they could defect. Maybe they could do this whole sob story and then be in jail for 2 years and make documentaries about how evil Nazism is. Now I've seen the light, blah, blah, blah. They did that before, by the way. There was a pilot who was shot down 7 or 8 years ago, and she was a very anti-Russian kind of Nazi-ish bitch. And then they like flipped her around into being kind of like someone who says that only peace is the solution, right? So these guys could get out like that, right? But there's 300 to 400 mercenaries. And I don't think that there's a third category of, I don't think this is about the shame. I don't think this is about the perp walk and, oh, look, there's NATO guys there. Which guy is? I don't think it's about that. And I don't think it's about secrets. Russians are totally in control of all the data coming out of there. They're in control. They're intercepting radio. They're hacked into the internet. They know exactly what these guys are talking about and what they're thinking. They've said publicly that they listen to their radios. That's what they've said publicly. So what else is there? We do, and people who know how the technology works and understand what I'm saying will know, yeah, there are devices that you can get that are physical devices that you have to be within a certain proximity, and you can sort of basically physically hack any internet if you're within a certain proximity using certain devices that work as if you're like, as if you, there was like you were splicing into the wires and pulling the data out like manually. You see what I'm saying? Like if you were to visualize that. So you, they don't work from around the world, but if you're like, someone could go up to the side of your house or something like that and get into your internet like that is what I'm trying to explain. So with these devices. So they got everything. And there are such thing as intelligence agencies, and there are such people called spies, and they probably have an idea of who's in there. These are very valuable hostages, and they're not, and I don't think that they're there in official capacity meaning that they're not there as from their army. The whole, this whole conflict, think about how much awareness there has been now about the difference between mercenaries. Think about how Russia has introduced this. Like you're not getting this from the cabal side. Are you right? Like, think about this understanding that you have. Oh, yeah. So if you're a mercenary, you're dead to rights, and they can actually execute you if they wanted to. Remember, you learned all that from those two English guys. So you've been red pilled on. Right? See how you've learned about this. So in a sense, this is actually a whole process of people learning. If there's high value people in there, there just has to be. Otherwise, just surrender. There's really not another angle. Yes. So let me know what you think. Tell me in the comments, what's the angle? Just briefly, and we'll touch on this tomorrow in greater detail. There's a lot happening with Moldova, Transnistria. We're going to dig into that. Maybe there'll be some more news by then that's worthy. Right now, it's just, yes, it's in 1992, this little tiny strip of Moldova, it's kind of like a tiny little miniature unofficial Soviet republic. It's basically a giant military base. It's a Russian military base, effectively. Like, we're being realistic and stuff. Like, I'm not interested in how Russia Today or Izvestia tells the fucking story to themselves. Like, that's their business, what they tell Russians. I'm not Russian. The reality is that it's a giant military base, and it's a important location geographically. It feeds right into Odessa, so you can just take Odessa. A Transnistrian force could just take Odessa. Like, you don't have to, like, what's this naval thing, or how's the Russian army going to come in? It just, Transnistrian can take Odessa. They also have like the largest stockpile of ammunition in all of Europe. It's there for the Russians to get to them. You see how this works? So that if Russia had to invade Europe, because they figured that someday they might need to, and maybe that day is soon, I hope not, but they have this giant stash of weapons and munitions there. It's apparently enough that Ukraine could carry on without needing any munitions from Western Europe for 10 years. It's so much stuff. It's like World War III levels of ammo in this little giant military base that's the size of a country called Transnistria. And it also has some effect on Moldovan politics. You have to know some things. There was a guy named Dodon, and there's a lot of intrigue there with the Moldovans and with Romania. There's a lot of bitter feelings from Romanians about how the Russians kind of set up Moldova. The concept of Moldova, like when someone says Moldovan, you almost think it's like, well, it's like part of the Russian Empire. You think it's like a, you know, Russian Moldovan, but it's actually Romanian. You know, they speak like a language like Italian. It's a very strange situation, but Ukraine is acting like maybe they want to take all these weapons, like they can go in and attack Transnistria and take all these weapons, and the whole thing could be a ruse. Like it could be the way this is set up there. I'm just, you know, I'm just getting you guys to think, you know, more concretely. Just thinking more concretely, how would they go into Moldovan Transnistria, the Ukrainians? I think that the Russians hit, I would have to look at a map, but I think they hit a massive rail line or bridge, that goes into the Odessa region that might make that more of a complicated, you know, I could be wrong. I read so much in a given day. It's sometimes the days blur, but, I don't know where these weapons are held in Transnistria, like where in the country. Yeah, I'm not convinced that there's necessarily a rail issue. You know, maybe there is, but maybe there's issues of bridges and roads. I don't know. But just think in terms of your basic contingency planning. The Russians have a very decent plan. Of course, snafus happen all the time. Situation normal, all fucked up. But the entire Ukrainian schema, their whole outlook is FUBAR, right? It's fucked up beyond all recognition. There's no way out of this for them. No good way out of this for them, anyhow. But yeah, they're talking crazy, like Ukraine's talking crazy, like on talk shows and stuff, and like, the, you know, they can go take this from Transnistria. Don't you fucking think that Transnistria is ready for this? I just assume that they, you know, I would just think that they're ready. they have just a tiny army. They just have like 5,500 or so active duty soldiers, but they have legitimately 20,000 personnel in the reserve who train, like a real reserve, and they have to go out like for 3 weeks out of every year and do some camping and shit like that. But that's it. Are they ready for it? And I would suggest that there is no, I'm going to suggest something very strongly, okay? There is no, there's no, how to explain this? There's no independent plan from Transnistria. There's no independent plan from Transnistria. There's only the plan, there's only a Russian plan. So if you attack Transnistria, it's another attack on Russia, which is fine because, you know, Ukraine kind of sees itself at war with Russia. Okay, fine. And that's why they think this is a legitimate target. The problem is that Transnistria also sees itself as part of Russia. And it's there's no like firewall, or is the general of Transnistria going to agree type of shit. Like, no. This is like a single integrated thing. They're part of the Russian army. They've got all the munitions right there. Do they try to go for it? Something bad happens, and then Russia says, okay, now we have Odessa. Now, we've seen a lot of hints for the past week about this. And there was some statements. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, we had the news about the human trafficking stuff and all of that. That was orphans, 58 orphans that were rescued from a plot to kidnap them. But if it had all been Ukraine, if Kherson wasn't liberated, then it would all just be the issue. It would all just be legal within their own country. So I just wanted to end with this. Yes, Denis Pushilin, right? He's the like the president of the Donetsk Republic, right? And he says, quote, after reaching the borders of the Donetsk region, it is necessary to start the next stage of the operation, taking into account what's happening in Transnistria and the shelling of the regions of the Russian Federation bordering Ukraine. That's a bit cryptic. Now, the shelling of the regions that he's talking about, of the Russian Federation bordering Ukraine, I think he's talking about that shelling being into Belgorod. Right. And because of that, then we're looking, it's like he's kind of speaking in a not so codish code, right? That to me seems like he's saying Sumy and Kharkov, but we already know Kharkov, so maybe he's saying Sumy. And then Transnistria sounds like he's talking about Odessa. It's just a few, I think it's like 50 kilometers. It's like 30 miles or 40 miles from Odessa to the border of Transnistria. That's pretty intense, right? What the hell is he talking about? And he's talking about the next phase. That's a third phase, isn't it? That's talking about a third phase, is it not? I mean, we're in the second phase right now, and that's about liberating the Donetsk region and, well, liberating the Donbass. And now he's talking about the next stage and what's happening in Transnistria. See, this region, sometimes called Bessarabia, looking at the activities looking at the posture of the Russian force, I know that they were attacking groups in between Kherson, like Ukrainian groups in between Kherson and the city of Mykolaiv, in between the city of Kherson and the city of Mykolaiv. And I would, you know, would they need to take Odessa first and then Mykolaiv, or the other way around? If Transnistria is going to be activated, it's a very small military force. And it's amazing that Ukraine didn't at the beginning go in and take some group of their Odessan force. I think they have 50 or 100,000, maybe 40 to 80,000 just in that area, because if they don't, they lose it simply because the opportunity is there. So tell me your thoughts. Do they take Mykolaiv? Do they take Odessa? Is the rump state left of Ukraine? Is it cut off? Is it a landlocked country? Are they going to have access to the Dnieper River? Are they going to be able to travel the Dnieper River into the Black Sea? Are they going to have a special permission for that? So there are many, 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 many questions. But certainly, as we have our main operating idea on this question on the show, is that the effort, the political situation, all the finessing on the diplomatic front, the economic preparation, the military preparation, the cost of it, the logistical issues already being there now, all of those point towards take it. They need to bridge this gap between Crimea and Odessa. Just like what you've seen with Mariupol, Beryansk, and Melitopol. What they've done in the Sea of Azov, they're going to need to do now between Odessa and Kherson. What do you think? I'll leave you with those thoughts tonight. Thank you for joining us on the show. We got deep into the mentality of Azov trapped there and what mind games they're actually trying to play, how they're trying to assume the sale and close the public on this and confuse people about what the humanitarian corridor is and then accuse the Russians of not following through on a promise that, in fact, they didn't make. This show is saved for those who support the work. It'll be on the drive. I'll get it up tomorrow, and also yesterday's will be up as well tomorrow. All right, take care. Have a great night.